presents a fascinating chapter in the history of Christianity. For instance, the first continuous Christian community in the peninsula was founded by Koreans themselves without any missionaries coming into the country. In their new book, A History of Korean Christianity, Dr. Kirsten Kim and Dr. Sebastian Kim provide the first English language study that covers the history of Christianity, including Catholicism, Protestantism, and Orthodoxy, from its beginnings in the peninsula to the present day. This thoroughly researched work skillfully weaves together such subjects as church-state relations, spirituality, and the global impact of Korean Christianity into a narrative that is easy for someone unfamiliar with the subject to follow, but deep enough that experts in the field will gain much from a careful reading. I hope you'll enjoy the interview. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies. I'm Dr. Franklin Roush of Lander University, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Kirsten Kim and Dr. Sebastian Kim about their new book, A History of Christianity, which was published by Cambridge University Press. Kirsten and Sebastian, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you.
Well, I wonder if you could begin the interview by just telling us a little bit about yourselves.
Yes, I'm Kirsten, and I was born in the UK. I graduated in maths, actually, from the University of Bristol, and then got more interested in church and mission work, and ended up going to study in theology, intercultural studies, and so on at a place called All Nations Christian College, which is where I met Sebastian.
Well, I'm Sebastian. I was born in Korea, South Korea, and I did my electronic engineering in my first degree. And then I was involved in mission ministry. And then I went to All Nations Christian College, where I met Kirsten. And after this study there, we got married, and we went to Korea, some ministries, and I did my Master of Divinity at Presbyterian College and Theological Seminary in Seoul, and I got ordained. And then we both went to Fuller Theological Seminary, where Kirsten did her MA, and I did my MTH. After that, we went to India, Union Biblical Seminary in Pune for 4.5 years. We were sent by the Presbyterian Church in South Korea, and we were there as a visiting lecturer, and we really enjoyed teaching there and interacting with the Indian colleagues there. And after that, we came to the UK to do further study. Kirsten did her PhD at Birmingham University, and I did my PhD at Cambridge University. And after that, we both worked in various capacities in various institutions and in the UK. And then I joined York St. John University about 10 years ago to hold the chair in theology and public life. And so I've been here since then.
And then I was teaching in the Selly Oak Colleges in Birmingham, but eventually I became professor at a neighbouring institution, Leeds Trinity University, where I'm professor of theology and world Christianity. So that's where we are now. We live in York.
Wow, so you've had a really... sorry, I had a little feedback there. Y'all have an amazing... kind of background studying this.
Yeah, well, it gave us a view of the world. We've written about world Christianity in general, but both our PhDs were on Indian topics, in fact. And then we started to work at a later stage on Korean topics, partly because people were always asking us about Korea. And we started to do research on Korea as well.
And is that how you came to write this book?
Well, yes. I think because we're writing papers on Korea, but there wasn't. We couldn't find recent histories of Korean Christianity, and when we looked at the older ones, they were either about Protestantism or about Catholicism, or they were sometimes only about one denomination. And we were having real difficulty putting it all together. And we noticed when we were examining PhD students, for instance, that each PhD student felt the need to give a potted history of Korean Christianity before they, at the beginning of their dissertation. But often it was very partial, it seemed. So we thought there really was a need for a decent one-volume history. And that's when we approached Cambridge University Press about it.
Right. And yeah, that's one thing I really appreciated about this was that you understand Christianity rather broadly in your book.
Indeed. yes, we tried to include Protestantism, Catholicism, which are often, you know, if you talk about one, you don't talk about the other, and it seems as though they don't have anything to do with each other. If you we also included Orthodox, and then all sorts of more recent varieties of Western Western style Christianity and Pentecostalism and so on. Yes, as broad as we could, and we also then tried to think about the church not only as an institution, but also as a movement, as different forms of spirituality. And we noticed in Korea that sometimes there's quite a difference between the way men practice their faith and the way women practice their faith. So we tried to integrate those dimensions as well.
Yes, when you look at the history of Korean Christianity, is often, as Kirsten mentioned, Catholics write about Catholic history, or Protestant writes about Protestant history, as if that's the only Christian history. So we thought of trying to integrate these two, because we believe that there are lots of interactions between these two. And also, in addition to that, there are various different denominations. So that's our emphasis, that we would like to see Christianity as a kind of same story with a different emphasis.
Right, that really came through very powerfully in your book, and that's one thing I really enjoyed about that. It was very difficult to do that because you're the first ones really doing it, and you did it very well. And I also like that you also talked about non-Christian religions in Korea and how we need to understand them to understand Korean Christianity.
Yes. Well, yes, because we were conscious that Koreans, we were trying to look at the Christian story also from the Korean point of view. There's a lot of material, especially in English. The material tends to be predominantly about the Western missionaries who went to Korea, worked in Korea. But we consciously wanted to write about the reception in Korea and by Koreans of Christianity. And of course, they were doing so through the lens of the traditions and the faith that they had grown up with and already had. We were conscious that that had also impacted the kind of Christianity that emerged. And in calling the book A History of Korean Christianity, we were indicating that Christianity is to a large extent indigenized in Korea. But some people seem to have come at it with more of a Confucian perspective. Others have come at it with more of a experience of popular Korean traditional religion and shamanistic elements and so on. So you find a mix of spiritualities within Christianity that and beliefs within Christianity that that reflect the different religious backgrounds of Korea.
And also, it's like any other religious traditions, Christianity were interacting with society and politics and economics. So that's quite interesting and important to understand how the Christianity has been shaped by the politics and the situations besides the religious matters. Particularly in Korea, religious traditions often associate with the state and existing government. For example, you have Goryeo dynasty, very close to the Buddhism, and then the Lee dynasty, is also very close to the Confucian traditions. And then the First Republic of Korea were very close to the Christianity. So you have a quite close interaction with the state and politics with the Christianity and the other religions.
Right, and so Christianity is being shaped by these different traditions, but also you have an argument in this first chapter that Christianity is also important for understanding recent Korean history.
Yes. You were going to talk about that, I think.
Yes, I think it is important to understand the history through the because Christianity has shaped a great deal in the modernization and also social political movements. In Catholicism, when the intellectuals studied Catholicism, they studied Catholicism not necessarily initially as a religious tradition, but as part of the Western learning and new ideas. So that was how they saw the Catholicism offer to the Korean context. And again, Protestant, when they initially made Protestantism and introduced into Korea, they saw that as a part of modernizing force and catalyst for the modernization of Korea. So they embraced the Christianity as part of their kind of broader agenda for nation building and also later on part of independent movement. So in order to understand Korean history, we have to understand history of Christianity and what's happening in the Christian churches. And of course, in order to understand Christian church, we need to understand Korean history. Yeah.
And so in the end, we structured the book around important dates in Korean history, not ecclesial dates. Well, anyway, the dates that are important for the churches differ according to which church you're talking about. But in the end, we have a political historical structure for the book. And in terms of our ways of explaining the attraction of Korea, of Christianity in Korea, we've given at least, if not more, attention to the socio-political than the religio-cultural in the end. Yeah.
Oh, excellent, excellent. So you had mentioned, I think Sebastian had talked about how Christianity is first coming into Korea, and that's what you kind of talk about in Chapter 2, where you're talking about how Catholic Christianity, the first kind of Christianity to really get into Korea and have a staying power.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could tell us what's kind of special about how that came in.
Well, within the Catholic Church, Korean Christianity claims a unique status in that the origins of the church are recognized as a lay community. Normally, the centenaries of a Catholic church in any particular country are when the hierarchy was established or when the first bishop arrived. But in the Korean case, the history goes 50 years further back to the lay community that was formed after one of the Korean scholars went to Beijing and took baptism from Jesuit priests there in China, came back and baptized his fellows and established this lay community. And that has huge ramifications actually for Catholic ecclesiology or theology of the Catholic Church globally, which Korean theologians would like to be better known, I think.
And also, in addition to that, I think there was some demonstration of Korean enthusiasm for this new religion and new learning, because it was the Koreans who went to Beijing, mm-hmm. wanted to learn about Catholicism and got baptized and came back to Korea. And they themselves actually established a community and the evangelism and so on and so forth. So that's quite interesting to see the Korean initiative and their enthusiasm. And I think that that's also passed on to the Protestant circle as well.
Mm. Yes. and perhaps that's always or almost always true in any situation where Christianity is it comes established. But very often we don't actually have the documentation to prove it. In the Korean case, of course, this is very well documented, which makes it interesting.
So what was it about Christianity that these early Koreans were interested in? What made them go out and bring it to themselves?
Yes, I think there are various reasons for that. I mean, initially, it was intellectual movement. It was the kind of accepted by the more intellectuals or the kind of upper caste of the group of people in Korea. So they actually formed a group of the scholars to study these what you call Western learning. So it's not only just a religious literature, but also including the Western philosophy, science, technology, and so on and so forth. So in that process, they learned that there are some integral kind of nature of Catholic teaching and Western learning. So they were got interested in the Catholicism. So that's partly is they're interested in Western learning, and also partly because of their reaction to the Confucianism or Neo-Confucianism, that they saw that there was a certain limits of the applying the Neo-Confucian ideas into the Korean context to meet the challenge of the modernity. So they saw that Catholicism may offer certain alternative to that. So they were quite interested in that. So it's partly because of their interest in the Western learning and partly because of this kind of religious elements that offer to the religious context of Korea.
Right, and did it just stay among scholars?
Well, I think it soon can be spread to the more merchant class or middle class, and then later on also working class and the lower class. So it was initiated by the upper class, but soon became the mostly available to be widespread among the various different parts of the section.
Which was then posed quite a challenge to Confucian society, which was organized on a very hierarchical and class basis.
So since you have this kind of challenge to this Confucian class-based society, what's going to happen to these Catholics?
I think they soon face the persecution. It's kind of few years after their initial introduction of Catholicism, they faced persecution by the government. There was very severe persecutions and a series of persecutions. So that's the really damaged the growth of the Catholic churches in Korea in the kind of initial stage. Partly because of their attitude toward the ancient veneration, because the Korean society was very highly structured and very much influenced by the Confucian social structure. And for Confucianism, the authority and Confucian social stability is very important, together with the Confucian the literature. So the ancestor veneration is very important to maintain the stability and also security of the society. So when Catholics refused to observe the ancestor veneration, they saw that's the challenge of authority, so they persecuted. But later on, again, Catholics were regarded as working with imperial power. That's very much obvious in the latter part of the persecutions, that they actually collaborated with the, let's say, French troops when they entered Korea. They helped French troops to enter Korea and supported. So later on, they discovered that. So the government saw that Catholics were anti-nation and against national interest. So they were persecuted.
The initial persecution because of the refusal to follow the Confucian ancestor veneration. They argued that they were nevertheless venerating their parents, but in a different way, but were required by the church to do it in a different way. That then, because they were then a persecuted minority, they then appealed for foreign help, and then that made the persecution and the situation of the Catholics worse until we get to 1866 and the years following that, when possibly half of the Catholic population was either formally executed or informally put to death or lost their lives because of the attitude of the society around.
Yeah, so for Catholics were a great dilemma, because in order to keep their faith, they wanted to have a support from the outside, particularly bishops in China and also some of the French imperial powers. But at the same time, they want to show their allegiance to Korea. So that was a great dilemma for Catholics in the time of the persecution.
Well, excellent, excellent. So that, yeah, kind of leaves on a, chapter two kind of ends on a very sad note in that
yes,
sense.
Indeed, mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
With these poor Catholics. But then, so Koreans, in the third chapter, those Koreans decide to bring in another kind of Christianity, Protestant Christianity.
Yes. Yes, again, there's more than one way in which it enters, but there are elites who are looking for alternatives to Confucian society is becoming more and more unstable, lots of social problems. There's the pressing the pressure of Japan as well as other Western powers on Korea to open up and to modernize. And the elites begin to see modernity after the model of the United States, particularly, and as founded on Protestantism, and using a kind of Confucian logic, I guess, about the primacy of the ideology or belief system in order to structure the society. They look to adopting a Protestant Christianity as a way of refounding Korean society and modernizing it dealing with some of the very pressing practical issues of their time. But you've also got Koreans who are exiled from Korea, particularly a group or individuals in Manchuria who meet Western missionaries, in particular Scottish missionary John Ross there, they seem to have heard of Christianity as a message of equality, dignity, salvation, answering some of their faith questions also. And they get involved in translating the Bible and promoting it and smuggling gospels into Korea and founding communities. So before any Western missionaries were permitted to enter Korea, again, you have lay communities of Protestants already existing, and some of the first baptisms are from those communities.
So why doesn't the government just start persecuting them?
Good question. Because the first missionaries who enter actually as doctors and educationalists, and not as not to promote faith. But the power of the government also is being. I mean, the government is split. There are factions some of which support China, some of which are supporting Russia, some are looking to the US, and some supporting Japan. So the power of the Korean government becomes more and more limited in this period. And eventually, even though it's not strictly legal, the missionaries start to move away from the places that they've been allocated in the cities and into the countryside, and engage in spreading the Christian message more widely. And always, of course, it's the Korean Christians who have been doing that on the ground before the missionaries actually get there. So usually when the missionary arrives, there's already a group of interested people.
And the political situation at the time is that after the period of a closed policy, the what's called Hallyu Kingdom policy, at that time the Korean governments were pressurized to open up their policy to make a treaty with the various different Western nations. And also the Koreans themselves also have a great desire to interact with the wider world. So there was some movement within the Korea. So I guess Protestant Christianity came into the kind of right moment.
Yes.
I always tell the students that usually Protestants have a better sense of timing.
But again, I mean, they only came because initially they could only survive there because they were invited by Koreans, of course, because Korea was never actually colonized by the West. So the situation of the missionaries was perhaps more precarious than in many other situations. But it depended which foreign power was in the ascendant, which missionaries were supported, and the extent to which missionaries could be active. So at one time there was an active Orthodox mission from Russia to Korea, but once the Russians were defeated by Japan, that in 1905, that had to end.
And does that have any role? I mean, this is the time that Protestantism will now eclipse Catholicism.
That's quite at that time it was quite obvious because it's partly because of the international politics, because in East Asia the power from the Europe is a bit fading away, and then American power was rising, so many of the Koreans saw that there is a power shift. But also, as Kirsten mentions, that the more kind of conscious elite, Korean elite, so the kind of accepting Protestant ethics and Protestant Christianity as part of their nation building, and also partly because the Catholics were still under suspicion by the government and also by the general people. The legacy of the persecution that Catholics were still working with the imperial powers. So Protestants actually deliberately move away from the Catholics. So they deliberately emphasize that they are different from Catholics. I think that's partly because of this division we have. That's the legacy of that period, initial period. Protestants emphasize that difference in order to introduce Protestantism in Korea. And partly also the Catholics were a little bit anti-modern at the time, whereas Protestants were very much into the modernism and introducing new ideas and so on. And then Catholics tend to be more priest-dominated, so you have a very hierarchical system, whereas Protestants introduced a lay movement and encouraging the colporteurs and translators, evangelists, to build the churches and to do evangelism and so on. So there were lots of different approaches And also partly, as Kirsten mentioned, that the introduction of the Bible that really helped people to read scripture for themselves, and then they...
Especially as it was in the vernacular, the Korean script, which made it easy for people to read even if they haven't had much formal education. Yeah. So Christianity, Protestantism could become a popular movement. The Catholics also had used Hangul, but not to the same extent. It's ironic, really, that the Catholics had started as a lay movement, but once missionaries were able to come into Korea, they tended to dominate. And whereas the Protestant missionaries were very thin on the ground and didn't have a lot of money and adopted something called the Nevius method, which basically meant that Koreans themselves would grow their own and support their own churches, leaving the missionaries free to look after hospitals and schools and institutions. And so that meant that Protestantism was much more of a lay-led movement.
If I just add, a Nevius method is introduced by the missionaries in China, American missionary in China. The basically idea is that three self movement is a self-propagating, self-supporting, and self-governing, and which is a very important principle for the growth of the Korean churches in South Korea.
Excellent. Now, you had mentioned there was competition among different countries for kind of influence in Korea. Mm-hmm. In 1910, Japan wins that competition and annexes Korea.
Yeah.
So, and you deal with that in Chapter 4, and you talk about how Protestant Christianity is kind of a threat to the Japanese colonial state. I wonder if you could tell me why that is.
Yes, because Protestantism had become linked with Korean nationalism for a number of different reasons. The missionaries had encouraged Koreans to think of themselves like Israel in the Old Testament, a small country sandwiched between empires, suffering, but nevertheless chosen by God. And the word, they argued that the word that they'd adopted to name God, the pure Korean word Hanamim or Hananim, actually meant one God, and indicated that Koreans had an understanding of monotheism even before they'd heard about Christianity. So that they developed this strong sense of Korean identity. And this encouraged Koreans who wished to distance themselves from China, initially, but it also then later had the same effect for Koreans wanting to stand up against Japan and assert that Korean ethnic and national identity. So this link with nationalism was clearly a worry for the Japanese and the Korean churches. They were always singing about the kingdom of God, for example, and how, you know, earthly empires were going to pass away, and you know, this kind of thing was a bit worrying for the new imperial power. And the churches were all Christians, and to some extent the churches themselves were bases of national resistance, and this came to light particularly in 1919 when there was an uprising against the Japanese, a widespread uprising that was the result of a movement that involved not only Christians but also Chandogyo, a indigenous Korean movement, and some Buddhist leaders. But almost half of the signatories of the Declaration of Independence in 1919 were Christian leaders and Christian pastors. And so this made very clear to the Japanese that this was a problem, and they took steps to address this. But they were also one of the main functions that Protestants were able to play in that movement was that because they, unlike the Korean, indigenous Korean religion, because they had international contacts, they could also raise the profile of the injustices that were being committed in Korea and cause a fuss in America and Europe and so on about the Japanese treatment of Koreans gain international support. So it was difficult for the Japanese to move against Christianity to the extent that they were able to move against Jundokyo and other forms of Korean religion.
And in addition to that, Protestant Christianity or Protestant church leaders established schools and colleges and educational institutions. And I think that's a very powerful tool for them to introduce the ideas and also independent mind to the young people. And the movement like YMCA, YWCA also were established by the Protestant Christian leaders. So there was a kind of combination of all these were quite a threat to the Japanese authority.
So what's happening to the Catholics during this time? Why aren't they proactive?
Well, I think the Catholics were also, there were some activities. I mean, for example, let's say An Jung-gun, who is the one of the key persons in this, who actually assassinated Ito Hirobumi, who was the resident general of Korea. He was visiting Harbin in Manchuria, and in 1909, he assassinated. He was a Catholic. Also, he was a promoter of establishing Catholic university and so on and so forth. And he was a reformer, but he was very much suppressed by the Catholic authority. As I mentioned earlier, the Catholics were quite still hierarchical at the time, and they were led by the foreign priests and bishops. And for example, Bishop Mutter was very much against any independent movement or any political involvement of the Catholics. So that's partly because of that, the Catholics were inactive, less active during this time.
And there's also the global situation of the Catholic Church during this period as well. The Catholics had a relatively recent memory of very severe persecution in France and in the heartlands in Europe. And during the period that we're talking about, from 1910 to 1945, the Catholic Church in Italy and in Germany was under threat and made concordats with governments to secure the continuation of the church and its activities with the agreement that it wouldn't interfere in politics. And so they also made a similar agreement with Japan, and the hierarchy obviously were tasked with making sure that the Korean believers didn't overstep the mark. So it was quite hard for Catholics to be active, whereas Protestantism was less controlled. Though some of the missionaries were quite strong-minded, but they were more easily able to be politically active.
Excellent. Now, one of the main strengths, I think, of your book is that it isn't just a political history. It's not just church-state relations. You talk about other things that are going on.
Yeah.
So could you tell me, what else is going on with Christianity during the colonial period?
Yes, well, especially because the pressure on the institutional churches meant that certain things couldn't happen publicly, and what could be said in church and so on was constrained. So that encouraged the lay movements and the house church movements and the movements in the mountains, the underground side of Protestant Christianity and also Catholic Christianity, though we found less information about that. It also led apparently hopeless political situation also encouraged millennialist movements that were looking for divine intervention to overthrow the Japanese Empire as the result of encouraged prayer meetings of various sorts emotional kind of outpouring of the concerns of the Korean people. So you also get some rather strange sort of hybrid Christian movements with a Christian influence at this time. And the Unification Church, which is has become globally well known, has its origins in movements in this period. But at the same time, that is an indication that Korean Christianity was becoming more and more Korean, and especially as missionaries were under pressure and were eventually forced to withdraw, Koreans were making Christianity their own and organizing themselves to a much greater extent. The pressures of the Japanese Empire also led to divisions amongst Christians as to how to respond. So obviously not everybody was into the millennialism, for example. Communists and Christians were antagonistic towards each other in the 1920s, but some Christians were very attracted to communism, and its social teaching seemed to be very close to Christianity in many ways. And then Christians were divided as to whether to work with communists or against them. And then later, when the Japanese insisted that Korean Christians should adopt Shinto rituals of various sorts, though again the churches were divided as to how to respond. So you get in this period the seeds of post-liberation divisions in the church, formal structural divisions that took place in the 1950s, are laid in during the colonial period. The underground nature of the church also encouraged women's spirituality of various sorts, and so you get leading women healers and so on, for example, practicing during this time, as well as some prominent male ones as well. Revivalist.
Excellent. So, of course, the colonial period doesn't last forever. Japan is defeated in 1945, and then, unfortunately, Korea is almost immediately divided.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you pick up with that in Chapter 5.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you could tell us, what role did Christianity play in North Korea before division, and what happened to it afterwards?
Yes, well, this is particularly interesting because North Korea was the stronghold of Korean Christianity. Certainly, there were more than half of Protestants were in the northern part of Korea and what became North Korea, and a third of Catholics also of the Catholic population were in that part of the country. And particularly the northern city of Pyongyang, which is now the capital of North Korea, had very high, relatively high Christian presence. It was even sometimes referred to as the Jerusalem of the East because of the number of church establishments of various sorts. And the Christians of Pyongyang, both Protestant and Catholic, tended to be more modern, more entrepreneurial, better educated than Christians in other parts of the country, or indeed many other Koreans in general. So they were also quite they were more well-to-do and more politically powerful. But following the division of Korea, some Christians chose to work with the communists and to join something called the Christian Federation. But many Christians were among belonged to the bourgeois society that the communists were against, that they were allowed to flee south if they chose to do so. So they get a large exodus of Christians to the south. But for those Christians who remained, eventually we don't hear anything more about, after a few years, we don't hear anything more about the Christian Federation. Once the Communist Party, the Communist Workers' Party is in charge, various steps are taken to suppress Christianity, and people who are inclined to be religious end up in the lower tier of North Korean society. And it's not until the late 1970s that we again hear of the presence of Christians in Korea, in North Korea.
And so, so in the North, Christianity becomes weaker, but in the South, it's going to become stronger. How does that happen?
As Kirsten mentioned, that there are lots of Christians actually migrated to the South. And according to statistics, between 1945 to 1950, about 5 million people migrated to the South. And out of 2,000 churches established in the South, nearly 90% of those churches were built by the refugees from North. So you can see the influence of the North to the South. And then politically, there were a number of political leaders were Christians. A key person was the Sung Man Lee, who later became the first president of the Republic of Korea, South Korea. He was a Methodist and strong Christian, and he wanted to combine his politics with Christianity, and so he wanted to so-called make Korea a Christian nation, and many of the Christian church congregation and leaders were supportive of these political leaders who want to establish the South as a Christian nation. So there was a great movement toward that. And partly also because of this migration from the North, Korean churches in South Korea were more conservative, and also they are more anti-communist, but also they are pro-modernity and industrialization and also democratization, and also many of them are pro-American. So that a combination of all these ideology and tendencies, people were strongly get together and they want to build South Korea on the basis of Christian notions and Christian ethics and Christian foundation. So that makes the Christianity in South stronger.
And I noticed there's the dividing year between Chapter 5 and Chapter 6 is 1961. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me, why did you choose that year?
Mm-hmm. Because this was the beginning of the military-backed government, although General Park was elected. Mm-hmm. There had been a military coup deposing previous the government of Syngman Rhee, and also a later the government of Syngman Rhee had collapsed, and Jiang Nan was deposed by the military government. Jiang Nan was only in power for a short period of time, 6 months or so, but he was a Catholic. So he'd had two Christian leaders who tried to govern in a democratic manner, but neither of which had succeeded, and Syngman Rhee's government particularly had become very very corrupt. Of course, with the proximity of North Korea and the threat, the antagonism between the two countries, because after the Korean War there was no peace treaty, and both governments were still claiming to have a right to the whole peninsula, both northern and southern governments. So many people were worried that any instability in South Korea would be taken advantage of by the North. It seems most Koreans were prepared to back the military rather than have the the instability of weak governments. And Christian leaders, Protestant Christian leaders and Catholic leaders also were inclined to agree. So 1961 was a transition in Korean society to the kind of mobilized, militarized system, which, although it suppressed human rights in terms of civil rights, and actually did quite a lot for people's social and economic rights, in that the military were determined to build up a strong and powerful South Korea, and so led the industrialization of Korea and the rapid rise of Korea as a global power was to a large extent to do with that leadership, even though of course there were many people who suffered in the process.
So how are Christians reacting to this dictatorship?
It's the reaction from the churches were sharply divided as politics. The more conservative or evangelical sections of the church, which is in terms of numbers, they are majority, they are basically go along with the dictatorship and military government. And in return, they receive the support from the military-backed government for their religious matter. So it's kind of unspoken kind of agreement that religious leaders will stay in the religious matter and politicians will stay in the politics, and they do not interfere with each other. So in many ways, they concentrated on the church growth and the evangelism and some social cares and so on and so forth. Whereas in terms of numbers, some small sections in the Protestant church and then the Catholic church were very much against the military-backed government for their human rights abuse and also various different aggressive attitude toward the ordinary people. What we call the Minjung movement were established there. And Minjung movement were not the kind of Christian movement only, but Minjung theologians and the Catholic theologians and Catholic church leaders were very much heart of that movement. So they challenged the authority and encouraged the other Christians to join them. So they were very much polarized. And there were lots of tensions between them, and of course, lots of human rights abuse by the military-backed government.
So the kind of majority of Christians were very involved in trying to Christianize South Korea. And once South Korea was established as a democratic nation, the numbers of Christians then becomes extremely important. And so they had deliberate campaigns to convert or to encourage people to convert and to become Christian. And these mass meetings, sometimes a million or more, gathered on Yeouido Plaza. And of course, these also sent a strong signal to North Korea, which had its own mass gatherings on the plazas in Pyongyang. That Christianity was alive and well and an opposing system to communism. But at the same time, as some Christians were celebrating in this way the growth of the church, other Christians were in jail and being tortured for their resistance to the military government.
So you have this conflict among Christians, and you have this dictatorship. Why is Christianity growing so rapidly?
Well, partly because of that, the deliberate movement to grow churches, but also because Christianity works closely with the development plans and the ideals for the growth of a strong and prosperous nation. So Christians are working hard with the government to build up industry, education, hospitals, and so on. And they seem to be very active in social matters and in social leadership and political leadership as well. And so becoming a Christian then is also a way of being upwardly mobile, of improving yourself and gaining, and the churches as communities are empowering for people in this period.
And also they were under constant pressure or constant threat from the North Korea, because people did experience the Korean War, and there were occasional conflicts between North and South. So the Christians were very much gathered together or drawn this idea of threat from North, actually helped them to gather together to pray for the security of the nation and unification of the nation. So when you see the mass evangelical movement, they always have elements of kind of threat from North Korea and pray for North Korea and pray for the security of the nations. That was a very driving force for the Christians to see the kind of urgent situation and also to engage in more evangelism and also salvation.
And you ended this chapter in 1988, which when there's a election in Korea. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about how Christians play a role in bringing that about.
So when we mentioned the Minjung activists that began with labor movements that increasingly were agitating for democracy in South Korea, and eventually the excesses of the military, the cruelty of the military government and the excessive force and suppression of the population become more and more marked, especially in 1980. The democratization movement in Gwangju was very very brutally put down by the person who shortly afterwards became the second military leader of South Korea, President Chun Doo-hwan. The spread of the movement for democratization then becomes much, much wider. And although most of the traditional church leaders are still supporting the government at a grassroots level, there are movements against it. And then the Catholic role becomes particularly significant.
Yes, particularly in this time, the later 1970s and the 80s, Catholics played a very important role in the democratization of South Korea. The Cardinal Kim Soo-hwan, who was the key person there, initially he was a little bit reluctant, but he fully engaged in the anti-military government. So the Myeongdong Cathedral, which is the key major cathedral in Seoul, was regarded as a sanctuary of democratization. So Catholics were very much involved in, and many of the young Catholic priests formed the group, and they're the ones who encouraged people and challenged the military-backed government and led demonstrations. So they were very much, people were very much impressed by their sacrifice and their active involvement.
Right. And so what happens with the Catholics? I mean, they're passive for much of our story, and all of a sudden they're active, and they're growing really rapidly.
Yes. And they continue to grow, though Protestant growth starts to falter in the 1990s. Catholic growth is partly on the back of this key role that they've had in democratization. It's also to do with their social capital in terms of the social care that Catholics are increasingly offering. And a lot of government, a large proportion of government social care by the time we get into the 21st century is being delivered by Catholic bodies of various sorts. I think there's also in the change from military governments and pushes for industrialization and modernization to the kind of into the democratic period where Koreans can enjoy the fruits of their labors more and society becomes more postmodern in many respects. The attitudes of the youth are different because they haven't experienced in the same way the privations of the Korean War and so on. There's in this new kind of culture in South Korea as well, there's the Protestant churches, which were so successful during the military period, begin to seem unattractive, old-fashioned, and also aggressive in their evangelism and in their attitudes also to other religions. And whereas Catholicism, which has been more open to the other faiths of Korea, and also seems to be more ethical in its approach, Catholicism becomes more attractive, and it offers a link with tradition and with European forms of Christianity that Koreans begin to discover.
So I wonder, as kind of a final question about your book, could you tell us what kind of role are Christians playing globally now?
I think one of the things we tried to do throughout the book was to say, well, Korean Christianity isn't only in Korea, and especially during the periods of instability during the 20th century, for various reasons, Koreans left Korea. The exiled community, the diaspora communities were interlinked and continue to be interlinked with what happens in Korea. But at the same time, they play an important role in many parts of the world. Post the liberalization of the Korean economy as well, we get more and more Koreans, Protestants first, and now increasingly Catholics, who are engaged in world mission of various sorts. Koreans feeling that they had received so much and were indebted and needing to repay the debt of the gospel and to share what they had received and the gifts that they believed God had given them with the wider community, particularly in poorer parts of the world. There are lots of Koreans involved in medical and other work in different parts of the world, as well as sharing the Christian message. It's also in a way wanting to celebrate Korean success and export some of the successful ways in which the church, that they understood that the church had grown in Korea. And many Christians around the world have heard of Korean church growth and the spectacular numbers and the mega churches and so on. So Korean Christians had gained a lot of confidence to share their particular practices, their particular style of faith. And other Christians also were looking to bring peace in the world and to address some of the issues that are still keeping the Koreas divided, when it's very difficult for the two Koreas to relate to each other directly. But by bringing wider peace, there's a possibility for reconciliation within the peninsula itself. So we get many Koreans prominent in Christian leadership, in theology, and so on, in many other parts of the world.
I think the Korean Christians have experienced great suffering in modern period when Christianity was introduced in Korea. In terms of secular history, Korea went through the terrible time of turmoil, and they believe that through the introduction of Christianity, both Catholics and Protestant Christianity, they have received lots of blessings and lots of insights from Christian faith. And so they would like to share with the other people in the other parts of the world. So although the growth of the Korean churches may not be as spectacular as before, but the enthusiasm of Korean Christians will still remain. So they are very much enthusiastic to share their gospel and to go to the other parts of the world. So the mission, kind of missionary activities, were very much a part of the Korean Christianity.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. And thank you so much. We've taken a lot of your time. So I'd like to take a little bit more, just ask you our traditional question. What are you working on now?
Well, we've recently received some funding from the Academy of Korean Studies, actually, to go in a bit more detail into the period 1945 to 48, the crucial period during which North Korea and South Korea were set up as separate nations, and to examine in a bit more detail what exactly the role of Christians and global churches was in that situation, because we think it's quite significant. So that's one thing.
I'm also involved in this book project, The Christianity and Politics in Korea, because it's offshoot of our project, History of Korean Christianity, because there are lots of interaction between Christianity and politics. It's fascinating to see the various different ideas and different interactions. So I'm working on the book project on this particular topic.
Yeah. And I'm also interested to take the ideas that are being developed in Korea, theological ideas being developed in Korea, in dialogue with the traditions and experience of Korea, and to look at how they challenge some of the ways that we do theology in the West.
Oh, well, those both sound like really fascinating projects. Hopefully we can have you on again.
Right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you again so much for being with us today, and thank you for our listeners. And please, this interview was not enough to get all the richness out of this book, so please go out and get this book.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us. It's been good to talk with you.
Right, you too. You all have a good day.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been New Books in Christian Studies. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll come back and listen again soon.